of the most effective and stimulating ways to enhance your overall experience at the University of Toronto is to become involved in governance as an elected member of the Governing Council. The University of Toronto announces the 2013 nominations for election to seats on the Governing Council and the Academic Board. The Governing Council is responsible for overseeing the university's strategic direction, finances, human resources, capital expenditures and infrastructure, academic quality, and the student experience. The Academic Board of the Governing Council is responsible for teaching, learning, and research functions of the university. Starting at noon, January 8, 2013, nomination forms for administrative staff, alumni, students, and teaching staff are available through the Governing Council website, governingcouncil.utoronto.ca, or you can pick them up at the office of the Governing Council, room 106, Simcoe Hall. Get involved and make a difference at your university.
Arthouse Theatre is thrilled to present the Canadian-made musical Robin Hood, the legendary musical comedy. A witty and hilarious twist on one of the most famous legends in the English language, that of the dashing, daring, and handsome man in tights, Robin of Locksley, who steals from the rich and gives to the poor. Directed by Halifax's Jesse MacLean and starring Daniel James, Kevin McPherson, William Foley, Jennifer Morris, Kelly McCormick, and Andrew Dundas, this show also features some of Toronto's best emerging talent. Robin Hood, the legendary musical comedy, runs from January 11th to the 26th at Hart House Theatre. Students get in for only $10 on Wednesdays. Call 416-978-8849 to book tickets and visit harthousetheatre.ca for more details.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Hi, welcome to Evidence here on CIUT 89.5 FM, the first show of 2013. Can you believe it? That year has finally arrived, and it'll finally disappear in another year. upcoming, and host Andrea Duff and Samara Thompson will be talking about the upcoming Dance Ontario weekend, taking place next weekend at Harbourfront Centre. Also, Joe Leslie, choreographer, movement director, dramaturge, etc., will be talking about Moving and Speaking, a class upcoming for dance artists, theatre audiences, artists, and others. But first up, we have Marie-France Forcier, artistic director of Forcier Stageworks, and composer James Brunton, and they're here to talk about the site-specific presentation of Lab Rat, showing now at Hub 14, 14 Markham Street here in Toronto. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. So let's start at the beginning of Lab Rats. What was, I guess, the spur to do a piece like this in which you literally turned dancers into experimental lab rats?
That was a really long process.
Okay.
It started about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
At first, it was really just a choreographic exercise for me because I'm way more comfortable choreographing for ensembles than doing solos, and I wanted to challenge myself and to no longer have that fear because solos are so much more exportable than group pieces in our day and time. So I applied for funding and I asked Julia Sasso if she would mentor me to choreograph solos on four dancers over the span of 1 year. So I was funded by the OAC and the TAC to create solos to stop getting so frustrated in the rehearsal hall when we were working, so that I would get more and more used to the workings of solos, basically. So I choreographed all those four solos, and that happened a lot at Hub 14 because I was renting that space as a rehearsal place. And it wasn't very conscious, but I ended up creating the solos leaning on the specificities of the space. And once I realized that, I was already attached to what I had created, and I didn't want to lose the intimacy and the relationship to the space. If I were to transport the work through a proscenium or a black box theater, so I decided to work with that and to create a site-specific work instead from the solos and create a full-length work that was an ensemble work for three, but to integrate those three solos within that frame. I've never done that. We've always produced 4C stage work shows in proscenium theaters. So it was a bit of a treat for me because I had all of those extra elements that I could work from. In the premise, am I speaking too much? Do you have any questions?
No, you've got to the premise, which is what I want to know.
All right, here we go. So around that time when I applied for those solos, I've been touring as a dancer for children's theater entertainment company for years, and I wanted to take a break from that. So in 2010, I took a break, and I realized after spending 10 years on the road with a bunch of people eating and sharing rooms and performing and traveling with people all the time, that I was a very different person when I was living on my own than when I was living with these people. And I assume that perhaps those discrepancies were universal in similar situations. So I wanted to work with that idea of exposing the differences between the solos, which would represent the person on their own, in the absence of the other as a witness or participant, and then create the group works or the group sections of the work that would expose how different they are when a person is there to influence their behavior. Mm-hmm. That is the premise.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay. The fact that it takes place, let's put it this way, I see it taking place in a box-like setting. So you have a person alone in a box. He starts off with a male, that's Brendan Wyatt, with mm-hmm. a hoodie, which is sort of like you get on a surveillance video, you know what I mean? He's like splayed against the wall at one mm-hmm. point, looking like he's being frisked. Yeah. So it's an isolation person of a person entrapped and trying to get out.
Exactly.
You know, and alone. Mm-hmm. Then you bring in the others, which then interact. Mm-hmm. But they interact in a way, I guess, with relationships, dominance, control, mm-hmm. helplessness, rage. All these emotions are coming out, and it's just like changes quickly, rapidly. So I see it as sort of the way people cope in an enclosed quarter. And if you live in a box-like combo for years, mm-hmm. this might be something seriously to think about. How would you describe how you choreograph the movements and what you're gaining in that?
Well, that is a very accurate interpretation of it, because the second part of my premise was to turn Hub 14 into a psychological lab space where I would bring people into isolation or into, what's the word I'm looking for? Sequestration in French.
Seclusion,
thank you. So, thank you. So where the people would be in seclusion over a certain amount of time, and how that room would turn their behavior.
Okay.
So, yes.
So what I said about aggression, confrontation, mm-hmm. et cetera, how from your point of view, does body movement vocabulary and psychological reactions mm-hmm. determine movement, et cetera, back and forth? In relationship, support.
In relationship to those feelings?
So yeah, all that happening out, which I saw in there, which is mm-hmm. sometimes drastic mood swings, too.
Yes.
Helplessness, like Heather a lot of the times is helpless mm-hmm. until towards the end, this yes. sort of thing.
Well, that works into, like, that is something that came later in the process. Mm-hmm. As the process was 3 years long, and towards the end, we did a two-week blast, not even 2 weeks. It was January 2nd to the opening day, which was mm-hmm. the 9th, so 7 days, where we put the piece together. And in those 7 days, I let the dancers really internalize their characters. Mm-hmm. And that is what came up from the nature of the vocabulary I had created. That is, well, I mean, with direction, obviously, but that dominance towards Heather just seemed to be intrinsic in the way they were already moving. Mm-hmm. So I pushed them a little bit further in that direction, and I think it worked really well. The performers did, in my opinion, a fantastic job mm-hmm. at really genuinely conveying those emotions. Yeah.
Now they're interacting, and if at some point, James, say something about it. you collaborated on this. I think, as I said, we're psychologically entrapped, because right from the beginning you show them locking the doors, so basically they're victims of their own entrapment, sort of thing. Suggested to me the mind was playing a big factor, because to me they could have got out at some point, but either one of the others is blocking. But even when it's locked, what happened? They can't even get out. They're still entrapped. And yes. I thought that was an interesting concept.
It's go ahead.
Well, I think that's a concept too that exists in day-to-day life as well, like in our relationships with one another. You see people who are in relationships that don't work, but they feel like they have no power over changing that, or can't, you know, leave. And it's yeah, I feel like that's what I take when I watch the piece, which I have many times. It's that reminder too that, you know, we're influenced by other people, and at the same time we are totally in control of ourselves, and it's really interesting to see it play out choreographically. So
did you find the hub space? I find the hub space, the white walls, some of them with seriously pathetic attempts to dab other paint over it. Very sterile, hospitalized, clinical. Heck, it would drive me mad right in that space. So it must have had an effect, too, if you're rehearsing over and over in a space like that. My God.
Especially for the last, because we were in there for we were in there many hours a day. But by that time, the piece was pretty settled. But it was the effect that I wanted to have, to use that clinical, sterile, inhospitable environment that looks really rough around the edges.
Right.
And there's a radiator, there's a window, there's two doors facing, you know, on the one side.
Yeah, and there's
wall.
Even the big sign, exit.
Yeah, there's a big exit sign.
With
that
no,
we could
no,
not
but it is no exit. Yeah. They're called the Peace Lab Racks, no exit.
That is true. Oh, damn it. I'll call you next time. there was something very interesting about that space, although it's very small, and we definitely give our audience a feeling of entrapment, which possibly contributes to the understanding of the piece. The space most definitely influenced where we went choreographically, and I believe musically with it.
Yeah. Your innovative use of a table, for instance, at one point it's pulled like off the wall, like, you know, one of these a condo or Hong Kong where everybody's leaving and everything is in the walls and everything, and it becomes a closet sort of coat, hanging coat there. It's usually, hey, a table's usually to eat on or something. But that sort of thing you're doing as well.
Yeah.
Sort of multitasking dancers. I don't know.
Brennan Wyatt is a moving man now.
You choreograph the bodies very intricately. They move extremely well and flow. But they also, to me, this is where I'm going to trap myself, have a certain deadness of movement, a sort of, not zombie as the world, but it's sometimes their bodies are dead, to my mind, and the faces are reacting. Like I remember seeing Wyatt and Molly Johnson were confronting each other in and around a table. It was almost at one point as if they were seeing mirror images of each other. So how are you working with that?
With the disconnects from the body to the
discussion in with their bodies and their faces, which I noticed quite a bit.
That is a very good question. I don't know that I worked with that consciously. I think it is something that...
Something that wasn't there?
It's certainly there. It is like I created the material, and then when I started giving it texture, I wanted a mirror section. And I wanted it to be ghostly. I think ghostly is a qualitative that I used a lot. Just as if your body was porous, perhaps. As if you were, and I think that we all experience that in our lives, or I certainly do when I feel like my mind and my body are not talking to one another.
Right.
And that's often when I am in a state of, I'm experiencing something emotionally, whether hard to process, or when I'm so stuck into intellectualizing something. And I think a state of shock also really has a repercussion on the body.
Yeah, that's the word when I said dead. Yeah. Traumatized. Yeah. Traumatized, the word I was searching for.
Mm-hmm.
It was traumatized body movement at times.
Yes.
The indication of.
Yes.
Particularly a few scenes with Heather.
Yes.
She was the weaker one. She was traumatized before she gets a little more.
Yes.
Pushy, as it were. Out.
Yes.
Okay, out. I've had enough. I'm not taking this anymore. But
that was a main direction in her solo, actually. It was.
Okay. There is an aquarium. Explain that, and then I'll throw back how I saw it. Yeah, it plays a very vital part, but I don't know how much you want to give away at the end. I think not.
Not totally.
But I think the idea, though.
The idea? Do you want
to... Or I'll throw out the idea.
No, keep going. Yeah, you're doing a great job.
Okay, well, when I choreographed the solo for Molly Johnson in 2011, it was just about the solo at that time, and I used an aquarium as a prop for her solo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the solos to integrate into Lab Rats. So I was stuck with an aquarium and a table. And I had to deal with them. So they became an integral part of the work. And I mean, like, we had a lot of fun trying to find separate purposes for them.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. At one point, I don't know where it was, Heather starts to fill the aquarium with water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somewhere along that point where I was getting scenes of, in later on in the end, it's more obvious about a fish out of water,
mm-hmm.
that if a fish is out of water, it's going to flap around and drown.
Mm-hmm.
But they're in a box, and if they go out, are they going to survive themselves? Because they're so used to being in that atmosphere.
Oh.
Can they cope outside? Because they can't cope in. And would they? What would be the result? That's how I saw that scene.
That's very interesting. I did not see that, but now I do.
That's so interesting. I forget to think outside of that box sometimes, actually, and what happens outside of it and how it relates. There's more to the reality than just what we see in there, and that's really interesting that you touch upon what happens outside. That's a whole other realm to think about.
That is really interesting.
Now, the other thing I want to hit on is humor. No, I know I was laughing. Bev was laughing beside me. how on earth did you think of the sequence where, you can see probably where I'm going with this,
yes.
Heather Berry goes to slams herself against the door in top knot. She's pasted up there in a sort of running posture, like a cartoon cutout, like you get with the coyote falling in that cartoon thing going splat against the door. How challenging was that for her? And it was just like the getting out motion, trapped, literally, it's frozen right up there.
Yes.
Cut and paste it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it moving like that for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, there it was. It was a risky thing to put there. Like, it could have flopped, but I think it worked.
She's always stable up there.
She's always stable up there. She's wearing boots. We used to do it bare feet, and that was really hard because it created a lot of pressure on her foot.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay. And another scene I liked is the table when it's used as almost like part of, like, why it's lying like a corpse on the table.
Yes.
And Molly's doing things like yanking his hair, putting his feet, plunking him in somewhere else. And then she puts on a toque and says, "Does that hurt?" Just like everything, "Does that hurt? Does that hurt?" While Heather's holding this lamp. I thought that was madly funny, but blackly amusing, given that there's a lot of things happening there. You could think of a surgical light thing or a surgical motion or whatnot. And it had when you use ghost, it had something, well, this has gone not into Saw, but another type of scenario here. And the lighting at that point. Leading to me, the lighting, that was darker, if I remember, just that.
Yes.
But overall, that bright light against the white walls has also an effect that's not very pleasant, too, on them, but also on us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to make the audience just as uncomfortable as the characters are. thank you for coming, everyone. that space is I think it worked well because the whites are wall and the whites are white. The walls are white and clinical. So to bounce some white lights against them just reinforces that idea of a hospital or an institution where people would be being treated for
that's
X reason, right?
That's a hospitalized wall, or that's what an image like that sterility is such that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, the music.
Mm-hmm.
How did you collaborate on that? What effects? How did you compose the soundscape?
All of it started when the solos began. So initially the work was for solos, and then it's amazing how much the music has changed since the solos became a part of the larger piece, because they all mean something very different than they once did. And the process was basically finding a palette of sounds to work from and sticking with them the whole time to sort of just create a consistent environment. The goal was to make everyone, to not distract from the movement with too many melodies or anything like that, and just paint. It's in a lot of ways similar to the lighting, like just make it feel like an environment that isn't a specific time or place, and that hopefully facilitates, you know, some of the emotion of the movement. And there used to be more, and as things developed, it just was less. We kept deciding that less was better, less and less. So there's a lot of drones and ambience and things like that.
Yeah, there was a sense of cold, glacial, metallic. I don't know what else, steely. Urban maybe is the wrong word, but we both felt that there was that.
I feel like that wine glass being touched, that creepy sound.
Yes.
I keep hearing it through.
Yeah.
Very little warmth.
So that creepy sound was glass being...
Well, to me it is. I don't
nothing know. Is... Yeah, there's... None of those sounds are
that
anything...
That synthesizer, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're all just created sounds, so it's... Mm-hmm. Even though things sound sometimes like strings...
Yeah, they did. I wondered about that.
Yeah.
They did.
Everything's variation, so it's... Because I think that with a piece like this, it's really important that things do stay open to interpretation, and I had to be reminded to just, like, you know, let the dancers dance and not get in the way of it, and let the movement speak for itself. And,
So that's
what I tried to do.
Well, so, and the last thing I just want to say is we, the audience, have become either scientists or psychology students observing the behavior that's going on here, and perhaps... Who knows what we're doing? Voyeurs, even? I don't know. And in your preview, that you have a trailer, it looked like a surveillance video. So that raised interesting, because they were totally in hoodies there. They are in this, which then camouflages the body if you're raiding a place to try to ransack it or whatever. But there's that sense. You had it frisking the wall of sort of a police sort of scenario, being watched, being observed, everything. So I thought when you start to think about it more, all these subtext keeps coming up, comes out that maybe even you're not even aware it's coming out. I thought that added quite a bit more to it as well. So anything else you'd like to say that we might have missed?
No, well, thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Okay, now, where? It's on tonight twice, and go from there, and how to get there. And
there is two shows, one at 7 p.m. There might be a ticket or two left. They're available at the door, and the box office is closed as of yesterday, and the closing show is at 9 p.m. Again, tickets at the door.
And it's 14 Markham Street. That's just north of Queen, one block. One block? Yeah, one block west of Bath.
Yes, exactly.
And don't walk past it.
No.
But you can't. Now you've got this.
No, it's obvious.
It's obvious. There's boxes.
Yes, you do.
Okay. Well, thanks again, both of you, for coming on.
Thank you.
In coming up, both Andrea Thompson and Andrea Duff and Samara Thompson will be on talking about the Dance Ontario weekend here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
All my life, I've been a good mama, I've been a good wife. I raised my family the best I could, and it all turned out pretty damn good. Now I'm ready to get back on the road again. I wanna rock that boat like it's never been rocked. Well, I'm feeling like shiny new car. I'm all revved up and I'm going far. I'm gonna play like a
Welcome back to Evidence on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Andrea Duff.
I'm Samara Thompson.
Samara, we are going to talk about the Dance Ontario Weekend that is happening this January, the 18th to the 20th. It is the 20th anniversary of this amazing weekend. It's family friendly. It's a whole lot of dance. It's $10 a day. Give me a break for so many different performances. And you're on the board.
I am.
Yeah. Have you been on the board long?
Yeah, quite a... I've lost track of how many years.
Really?
Quite a lot. 9, maybe?
Really?
Yeah, I love Dance Ontario. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it, too.
And the Dance Ontario Dance Weekend, I would say, is my absolute favorite event. Some of you may have seen the IMC a fair bit of it, which is fun. And this year is going to be amazing. As I said, or as you said, 20th anniversary. And we have 10 new groups coming this year that we've never had before.
Who are they? Well, you have to list all of them. Somebody?
Are you
excited about?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot.
Oh, sorry,
there.
Samara. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm actually not sure which ones are the new
LR,
ones.
There's an LR company. Are they new?
LR?
I can't remember. LR Productions? No. By the way.
But one of the two things that we do have that I can tell you about is we have two commissions that are presenting world premieres. So the first is by Gadfly, and they're creating a work called Stigmata, and it's a work for 6 dancers performing on point to a score that mixes house with tracks by Dr. Draw. And it should be pretty amazing.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and Gadfly's work is always really...
Yeah, it's fun, it's lively.
Strong.
It's very, very audience-friendly.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Benjamin Landsberg, who is working with 5 dancers, transforming a space into imagined combative area of identity synthesis.
Whoa.
And I know that he has dancers coming in from across the country for that one.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, and then Kara Spooner is doing a site-specific work as well on Saturday and Sunday, so it should be kind of interesting to see all the stuff going on.
It's a great weekend, especially if you're not particular... Well, it's a great weekend across the board, especially if you're not particularly familiar with dance, or you think to yourself, what does Middle Eastern dance look like? What does Korean dance look like? What is contemporary dance? Which is a whole other question. But if you wanted examples of these kinds of things... that are, it's accessible price-wise too, and it's so family-friendly. You just kind of, it's kind of like a film festival, but for dance.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it runs on Saturday and Sunday from 1 to 7, and on Friday from 7 to 10.
Right.
And Friday is mostly youth groups dancing, and Saturday and Sunday, it's pretty much the best of the best in the city. In the province. Like, it's amazing the companies that come in, and it's such a treat for $10 or more if you'd like.
Yes.
You get to see some of the most amazing talent this city has to offer. And, you know, you get little snippets and there's a little break. It's an excellent place to take kids. Every year I get stopped by patrons who love it. I've had some wonderful comments from people with kids because it's a financially easy way for them to bring them and expose them to different styles of dance.
And it's non-committal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're free to come and go.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not while people are dancing.
Ideally not, no. But, you know, you can kind of choose your own adventure with the weekend.
Absolutely. We're also doing something new this year. We're having tweet seats.
What does that mean?
Well, a tweet seat, they're going to be in the back couple rows of the theater, and we've just started a Dance Ontario Twitter account.
Okay.
So we're hoping people will come in there with their cell phones. We're asking you to actually turn them on and tweet what you're seeing.
No way.
Yeah, we thought it'd be kind of a fun way to do it. It's funny because for so many years we've done the, please turn off your cell phones when you're... Turn off the ringer, but turn them on and tweet.
Potentially dangerous, but it's exciting.
It's
exciting stuff.
Yeah, and it's only the last couple rows, so it's not going to bother any of the patrons further down as well with the light.
With the light glow.
Yeah.
Why do you think that this, beyond everything that we've said, but I mean 20 years running, why is it so successful?
Because it encompasses so many different areas of dance, and it's such a laid-back, friendly atmosphere. So you touched on it. You can see Egyptian dance. You can see flamenco. You can see, hip-hop. I believe there's some ballet in there.
Oh, for sure.
You've got COBA, the Collective of Black Artists. You've got Arte Flamenco. Modus O, which is always a lot of fun contemporary upbeat, fabulous. I mean, there's just such great companies. JD and Tracy Norman.
Yes, yes.
Arabesque.
Yes.
I mean, it's just, there's such a wonderful smattering of art. And like you said, you come and go. So you've come for a couple hours and you're not really, you want a little break, you want to go for lunch,
yep,
go skating down at Harborfront, come back, go watch some more.
Yeah, it's a full day.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you come, I mean, in the evening, a Friday evening, you have the evening, which is great. But then if you wanted something to do with the kids, to tire them out a bit, Saturday and Sunday, come, skate, have a snack, nap.
Yeah, my little boy's coming.
I'm sure he is.
But,
so that's the Dance Ontario weekend. Again, it's down at Harborfront Center. It's going to be in the Fleck.
Yeah, in Fleck.
Yeah.
Yep. And there are no reserved seating. It's at the door.
Yep.
So it's $10 or more as a suggested donation. No advance sales. For more information, you can go to the website, mm-hmm, www.danceontario.ca, and click on the link that talks about Dance Weekend 13. And again, performances run Friday from 7 to 10 and Saturday and Sunday from 1 to 7.
Is there something you're going to check out specifically?
Me? Well, I try and watch all of it as much as I can from the wings because it's...
Spoken like a true board member.
Yeah.
We're going to be right back in a few minutes with Joe Leslie.
Done me wrong. You hurt my eyes open, I don't lie. Tables turn and now it's your turn to cry. Cause I used to love you, but it's all over now. You used to run around with every girl in town. Spent all my money playing high class games. You put me out. It was a pity how I cried. Tables turned and now it's your turn to cry. Cause I used to love you, but it's all over now. Yeah, cause I used to love you, but it's all over now.
CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome back to Evidence on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Andrea Duff.
I'm Samara Thompson.
We're still here, and now we have Joe Leslie with us. She is a choreographer, movement director, dramaturge, director, and coach. She's going to be in town teaching a workshop at Hub 14 from February 4th to the 25th. It's going to be Monday nights consecutively. She's the co-founder of Montreal Studio 303. Basically, what hasn't the woman done? And we only have 25 minutes, so we might as well get moving.
So to start with, we would love to know a brief background. I mean, your background is so diverse from you studied under an associate of Mary Vigman's. You've trained at Ailey School. You have a you've been influenced by Jung. You've been all over the place.
Yes.
So
So my background. Okay. Well, I started dancing when I was 4. My mother was a dancer, so I didn't have much choice in the matter.
Looked like it was a good choice in the end.
In the end, yeah. A lot of hoops, though. But at a very young age, I was like 11, I was really frustrated by the lack of expression in the dance that I was studying, which was R.A.D. ballet. So for me, dance has always been about expression of the whole person. So, and this will eventually tie into the somatic work that I've done and that I do, but from extremely early age, that was always my feeling, that it's the whole person as a performer is what's important. So I very quickly gravitated towards theater, physical theater, and movement improvisation when I was 16, 17. And then I moved here when I was 17 and studied with Till Teal, who was she was the principal of the Vigmund School. She was one of Pina Bausch's teachers, and she was a master of expressionist movement, and I trained with her for 3 years here.
Did you find what you were looking for once you started branching out and doing the more theatrical and expressionist movement? Was that...
Absolutely.
This is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And did your earlier training start to make more sense or to become more relevant when you were doing that, or was it something you just let go?
Oh, no, because I... for me, craft is very, very important. Mm-hmm. So as much as I'm an improviser and work improvisationally and performed improvisation, I went back to studying ballet. I went to the Ailey School. I studied at a very high level so that to integrate. So because in order to communicate, you have to have full control of your craft. So for me, that's both the technical and the expression, and it's important to have both.
So what was the next step from there? You trained, you were highly trained.
Well, I was, after I'd been at the Ailey School, I was back here and I was doing a combination of collective theater and dancing, and started improvising at the Music Gallery and working with musicians there, got introduced to contact improv and those forms. And then I worked with Linda Rabin here, and she was then moving to Montreal, and she invited me to come to Montreal and to be a part of the studio that she was creating. And so I moved there in 81, and I was one of the first teachers at LADMI. And that's really where I had my dance career, was in Montreal, mm-hmm. through the 80s into the mid-90s. And teaching was a big part of that at LADMI, and then at Concordia, and then founding Studio 303.
Yes. I love that space. Been there.
Thank
it's
you.
A great space.
Yeah.
I just want to go back for a second to that 11-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, do you know? Do you know now even what it was that you needed to express so badly, that you needed to... I mean, I don't even think I would have had that kind of awareness at 11. I was just sort of being like dawdling along, doing what everyone told me.
Well, I had been trained since I was 4.
Yeah.
And when I very first started dancing, I did creative movement and then went into ballet. But I wanted to join the circus.
Here it is! Here it is!
And I actually became a gymnast.
Right.
Because I wanted something that was, much stronger physically, a much stronger physical expression.
Oh, right, more than an emotional thing that you were trying to communicate at the time?
Well, at that time, it was the physicality.
Right.
But, I mean, as I understand it now, I mean, they're totally integrated.
Yes.
So I didn't want to be expressing very light, kind of Giselle-type emotions. I wanted to be tumbling and flipping and flying through the air and that kind of thing.
Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah.
But now you work a lot as a dramaturge.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought all of this past experience, and now you're basically, well, for lack of a better term, it's also an outside eye, or you're looking at... the dramatic element of pieces, right, and helping people.
Well, yeah, a big piece that we haven't talked about is in 1990 I began teaching at the National Theatre School.
Right.
And I was the principal movement teacher and coach there for 11 years. So for me that was a huge learning curve in terms of language, articulating ideas, Shakespeare, so many things, and also using all the improvisational work and body language work. And through the 80s I'd done a lot of somatic work, body mind centering and so on, and like I say, all the improvisation, and bringing that into a theatrical context.
So that was a huge game changer for me. And then I've worked for many years as a movement director and choreographer in strictly in theater. And then over the years of doing that, was feeling like I really wanted to bring these skills back to the dance community in terms of directorial eye, working with dramatic structure and so on. What is the choreographer trying to communicate? Mm-hmm. How can they best communicate those ideas? So I actually was talking about dance dramaturgy about 10 years ago, but people weren't that interested at that point. It was too soon. But, you know, gradually over the years, it's become
a thing.
A necessary thing. And now it's great that choreographers are open to it. And why should choreographers have to be in charge of everything? They don't necessarily have the skills, because that's not their fault. Mm-hmm. It's a lot to do with the training. So there's a need for dramaturgy, and it's good timing for me.
So who have you worked with?
Who I worked with? Well, at the moment I'm working with Cinéart Dance in Montreal. I just worked with them in November, and I'm going back for all of March. They have a premiere in April. Last year I worked with the Dietrich Group, with D.A. Hoskins, for their world stage remount of Paris 1994. And I did a lot of work with the Chimera Project with Mal.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's last year.
When you were in the National Theatre School, you said that it was a huge, or working with them, it was a huge learning curve for you.
Mm-hmm.
And when I, as someone who doesn't have a lot of she's also sick and managed to show up, which is amazing. I hear Shakespeare, and I don't have a lot of, not being an actor, I don't have a lot of experience, but I know that that's such a classical, it's like almost like classical ballet. It's like mm-hmm. the people have a very set idea of the way that these things are played out, I think. As when you were in the National Theatre School, was that a struggle at all for you to find new ways to express these same ideas, older ideas, or find fresher ways to do that, or was that even your role there?
No, that wasn't my role there. I think for me, it was a lot of learning about the language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is iambic pentameter, for instance? Well, you know, it's a 10-meter verse that and it's on the heartbeat, and that's what Shakespeare's written in. Okay. Which is extraordinary.
Yes. Thank you for telling me that.
And when it deviates from that, it's because of a shift in the emotions. And, you know, I mean, you just learn these incredible, incredible things that are completely pertinent to movement, to character work, and so on. And, I mean, that's one small, small thing. For me, learning about the language, working in language, and being able to articulate ideas, which was really lacking for me in the dance world at the time. And I really was so thirsty for those skills. And I was able at the school, because I was part of a small core staff, there were so many visiting directors and teachers mm-hmm. from all over the place to learn from. And it was just a very, very exciting time for me.
Did you move into acting?
Personally, no.
Yeah?
No, I actually stopped dancing while I was at the theater school, while I was teaching there. Yeah. Stopped performing.
Was that a choice?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, was it just something that happened, or was it that you got caught up in your work, or did you decide, I'm not going to?
Well, it kind of was petering out. I'd had a second child, and so I was raising two children through, you know, all of these things that I was doing, and, you know, pretty much full-time position at the school, and then also freelancing. And then I also started working as a dance journalist, and writing started to take off. So something had to go.
Right.
And actually, my body was going. I was getting injured because I wasn't staying in shape enough for performance. So it was time.
It was just time to move on.
Yep.
And then how did the 303 space come to be in Montreal?
Like I say, I had been there from the early 80s teaching at LADMI, and part of that whole dance boom that happened in the 80s,
yeah.
which was so exciting. And then I was also teaching at Concordia in the dance and theater departments as well. And there were some of us who were, you know, talking about an alternative space, because LADMI didn't begin as that 3-year program. It was a studio with different classes and so on, but it became more and more the institution, the school that it is. And there were some of us that were wanting other kinds of training and also a performance space.
Right.
And that actual space was Jo Lachey's studio before. She had a company and a studio, and I taught at that her school then. Excuse me. And actually, myself and Andrew Harwood and some other improvisers started doing a series of improvisation performances in that studio. And they were packed. So we went, wow, this is, something's really happening here. Right. There's really a need for this.
Yes.
And Tangente had started to step up from being a grassroots place to another level. So there was that grassroots slot was kind of open,
right.
And there was a need. So in opening the studio, a big part of it for me was to have a performance space. So I could perform whenever I wanted to.
Of course.
And, you know, that we could have a more grassroots performance environment for new work and for improvisation.
When you perform, when you were working, who is it that you would trust to bring in to help you with your process?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a theater director at the time, Helene Springer, who I'd met here. A very, very intense, amazing theater person. And she was interested in my process and what I was doing. And we'd gone into the studio here. And then she moved to Montreal soon after I did. And she would come into the studio and work with me.
What was it about her particularly? Did she challenge you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. I mean, why else are we doing this, right?
Good question.
And I really challenge the people that I work with. And because we have to. How else is the form going to grow? How are we going to grow as artists? You know, it's not by people saying, oh, yeah, that's nice. Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Yes, exactly.
No. What are you saying? What is it you want to say? No, I'm not seeing that. How can you go further into that, you know? And she had a kind of fearlessness that really made me grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you're here.
Yes, I moved here a year and a half ago.
We got you back.
30 years.
And before we run out of time, I'd like you to tell our listeners a little bit more about the workshop that you're doing at Hub 14.
This is it's part of a Hub 14 initiative called Community Chest, where they invite an artist to come in and they give the space. And so this class, it's going to be 4 Mondays in February from 6 to 8, and it's called Moving and Speaking. And it's something that I've been trying to get off the ground since I've been here, which is to have actors and dancers in the same room. And it's to combine the skills and the experience that's needed in both forms. You know, so many dancers now are expected to act and expected to speak and sing, and they don't have the tools.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very hard for them. And of course, actors need to be able to move.
Yes.
So I'm putting the two together and creating a space to so we can move and speak.
And one of the other amazing things about this is that it's pay what you can. It does not happen often.
Well, that's because of the kind folk at Hub 14 who are giving me the space. So this is part of the thing, that it's reciprocal and that it's a cadeau, je parle français. It's a gift for the community. And it's also an introduction to my work here, too, so, you know, to get that moving.
Yeah. One of the things I read about you is that you always start your classes with an improv. I think you have a name for it, which has completely slipped out.
Dance of the Day.
Thank you. I'd love to know more about that.
That's actually in the creative process that I use that rather than teaching. I actually haven't taught for a long time, except for a few workshops here and there. So this is kind of just coming back now. But Dance of the Day I use as a creative tool. As a way for the for everybody who's working, the choreographer, the dancers, to arrive in the space and to have a few minutes to dance, witnessed by the other people in the room. And when I'm creating, it's a way for me to observe the dancers that I'm working with in terms of them in their own vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
and which is something that I always seek to integrate in the work. I don't try to impose a whole completely different stylistic thing. I'm more interested in drawing out the people I work with. So the dance of the day, and then they also get to see me moving as well.
Right.
And it's a way to arrive. That's the main premise of it.
It's very intimate, though.
My work tends to be, that word has been used a lot to describe my work.
Yeah. It's very, it almost sounds vulnerable.
Well, if you can't be vulnerable on stage, you shouldn't yeah. be there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But sometimes it's easier to be vulnerable on stage than it is in a close environment. And the same idea that it's easier to tell the truth to strangers than it is to your closest friends. Sometimes.
But it's part of the craft, and mm-hmm. it's something that needs to be practiced. And
yes.
I don't think that you can expect performers to be vulnerable on stage if they haven't been practicing it in the creative process and rehearsal process.
Fair. Mm-hmm. Fair. You challenge Jo Leslie. She's got a great smile, but I don't know. She's a challenging woman.
Yes,
who haven't you worked with yet that you want to work with? If anyway, even if
oh,
they're here.
That's well, I have worked with Rubber Band, and I really want to work with them again.
That's a great company.
I love those guys, and I actually was very fortunate to have worked with them 2 years ago. It was a really great experience. That's so tough. It's a bit. Yeah, there's so many people.
Well, let me just shift the question a little bit. Then, are you taking more clients? Are you willing to? Do you have time to work with more groups?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be continuing with a couple of people that I've worked with already later this year. I think it's really important to develop relationships, because the first time round you get mm-hmm. kind of, you know, to know each other, and then it's like, okay, this is working. Let's yes. continue. Let's go further. So that's exciting, and that's starting to happen for me here. And I'm open, you know, like... If you want me to come in and just look at something and give some feedback one day, or if it's, you know, full on for the production, there's all kinds of ways of going about it.
Excellent. Thank you for coming in to speak with us.
You're most
welcome.
It's been
a pleasure.
Thank you.
I feel like we could have gone a whole hour, to be honest.
For anyone who wants more information about the moving and speaking workshop, it's at Hub 14 Studio, and you can get information at joleslie33@gmail.com. There's also information on the Hub 14 website.
Yes, there is. Mm-hmm. You have been listening to Evidence on CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned.
I'm starved for affection, don't strive for perfection, just someone to catch me should I fall. Band's finished playing outside, still raining. I look around and there's no one at all. Rough edges and ragged hearts come together just to fall apart. Living is a dying art. Rough edges. Rough edges and ragged. come together just to fall apart. We're living to die in our profession. Like a well-worn dance floor, I wear my hair up so I can stand tall. The music surrounds me like the arms of a lover. Just because my words spin, does it mean I'm a
single file? Promenade.